I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
You are watching the Deadfoot Diver Podcast with Kurt the Deadfoot Diver.
Diver Podcast, where we talk about everything diving, tech diving, and especially the benefits of diving with disabilities. And today, I'm very pleased to have on today a legend in the diving industry and also a true life dive detective, Mike Fletcher. How's it going?
Good, good. Great to see you again, Curtis, after all these years.
I know, it's been quite a while. I mean, the last time I physically seen you, I think I was actually on your boat trying to dive the Atlantic and we got blown out.
Well, that could be, yeah. And we're talking 1991 that the Atlantic story was first, you know, brought to the public's attention. So sometime after that, I don't know, you were a teenager.
I was probably 21, 22 or something around there.
In 91?
Yeah. Okay. I'm old now, man. I'm like 56 this year, so.
Okay.
So tell me, first of all, how did you get into diving in the first place?
It's the same story that a lot of divers have. Very curious, and when you see something that really piques your curiosity, then you pursue it. And that's a simple story. I saw diving on television. We didn't have one on the farm. My grandmother had one in town. So I would see divers on television, and I was hooked.
Cool. So then you went on to, let's talk a bit about actually my favorite shipwreck that I'm enamored with because I've never dove it, the Atlantic. How did you end up finding the steamship Atlantic?
Well, it of course is a rediscovery, right? The Atlantic was lost in 1852, and shortly after it was found or lost, it was relocated because unlike a lot of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, it had a lot of monetary value. So, and especially the American Express Company wanted their money back. They had a shipment on board the Atlantic that contained gold and bonds and all kinds of things that were the kind of currency you used back in 1952. And the American Express people wanted that back. They contracted a diver. And it was relocated shortly after it sank in 52. The gold was recovered in 1855. And then we relocated it in 1984.
Wow. So that's quite a while ago. That was a long time before I met you, actually, or a few years.
Yeah. And the public didn't know that we collectively had rediscovered the Atlantic, unless you work inside the federal government or the federal government, and both those branches received letters, registered letters, and personal contact that the Atlantic had been found, asking their instruction on how to go forward.
Now, when you did that, that caused a whole uproar because I remember this company from the States coming up and arresting the wreck and doing all this stuff. In fact, I remember you showing me the flag that they stuck on it when they decided to do that. How did they end up finding out about the wreck in the first place?
Well, it's hard to say, but they had some really dubious characters that were their divers. And they had a known history of diving on wrecks and recovering things. And then one day, however they found out about the Atlantic, they were diving it, recovering things. And then I think it occurred to them, wow, this really is a special wreck. Why don't we try and own it? And they came up with a sketchy process where they claimed they owned it. They claimed to have brought back a previous company that had been defunct for a century and claimed that they owned it. And by re-registering the company, they owned that company's assets. And one they claim was the wreck of the Atlantic. So now they said they had ownership. But there is a trail right back to me that those sketchy guys in the beginning, they knew that I had found it and they actually were spying on me. It's a crazy world. It's a crazy world.
So who actually did you end up actually owning the wreck, or is it still owned by the Canadian government, or who specifically owns it now?
Well, we all went to court, the treasure hunters from California, myself, and the Ontario government, because the Atlantic is resting on the bottom of Lake Erie on the Ontario side. They, of course, had an important ownership consideration, let's put it that way. So in the end, after the long drawn out lawsuit, it was decided that the Ontario government owns the Atlantic because it was in fact abandoned by its original owners. And because it is on their land, they own property that is abandoned. It's old, old law, and it goes right back to the Crown of England.
Which it's funny because over in England, I just had a guy on my show, you can actually buy a shipwreck over there. Like he bought one off of Facebook for like $300 or £300.
Yeah. Well, they have a much more liberal approach to ownership. And I mean, they have so much history because they're so much older in terms of colonial history. Canada has lots of great ancient history, but us, the Europeans only arrived here a few hundred years ago. So our history seems to matter more than the traditional native history of North America. So England has this great long history. They're less interested in modern shipwrecks and way more interested in ancient history or early history.
So did you end up actually getting to keep any of the artifacts that you had recovered off it? Because I know you had recovered quite a bit of stuff, right?
I did. And I tried to bring that to the federal government's attention. The receiver wreck at the time, which was the natural process, said, this is all really dubious. We don't know who actually has control anymore. The province was vying to take control of shipwrecks that were lost inside their territory, but the law still didn't support that. But that didn't stop the Ontario government from making claims about ownership that weren't in fact supported by the law. So when the Californians forced the issue, the treasure hunters forced the issue in the courts, then anybody who had an interest had a chance to come forward. I came forward. The federal government said, as long as it's in the Ontario court, we're not going to make a claim of ownership, only that federal law does apply. But they bowed to the Ontario government's court, and that's where it ended up in the Supreme Court of Ontario.
Ah, cool. So let's talk a bit about how you ended up getting tied up with Clive Cussler and being on the Dive Detectives with Warren.
Well, the Atlantic got a lot of attention, not just on here in Canada, but, you know, internationally, the story was on Good Morning America. And here on our side, it was, you know, covered by every major network in Canada, BBC, CBC. They all did stories, and my face ended up on television a lot. And one day I got a call from a producer who said, you know, Mike, you've got this history of interesting shipwreck discovery already. What if we teamed you up with a guy like Clive Cussler? And of course, Clive was a hero of mine at the time. And for a lot of the right reasons. So yeah, when that door opened, I was glad to leave commercial diving for a while and go into the world of television and underwater exploration.
Which is really cool, because I mean, you got to dive on some incredible wrecks when you were on Dive Detectives. I mean, out of all those wrecks that you guys did, what was probably your favorite or coolest wreck that you've done?
Well,
which I know it's hard to narrow down.
you make reference to the Dive Detectives. That was only one series, and that was 6 episodes. Warren and I have done 100 episodes of underwater television, not just Dive Detectives. But the one that most people know me and Warren from is the Sea Hunters with Clive Cussler.
Yes.
And of those 100 episodes of television, it's hard to pick a favorite, but there certainly are some that were milestones in shipwreck discovery. The USS Flyer in the Philippines, which we found and relocated. We didn't relocate that. We found it for the first time. That wow. was a big deal. That was a really big deal, especially to the Americans. It mattered a lot. The Flyer was a submarine lost in World War II, on the outset of World War II. We found the Carpathia with Sea Hunters, which is, of course, is the ship that saved the survivors of the Titanic. She was sunk yep. after her role in saving those survivors of the Titanic when she was sunk by a torpedo in World War I. But we knew if we could find the Carpathia, which was no easy task, hundreds of miles off the Irish coast, then we could tell the bigger story of Titanic and how Carpathia was an important part of that. So. That was a big one, but Curtis, there's like 25 shipwrecks that we found, mostly submarines, oddly, but you know, we found airplanes, we found, lots of important stories that, help rewrite history, which, who gets to do that every day.
Yeah, true. I mean, how many, you found multiple U-boats as well, correct?
3. We found U-21. U-215 was a really big discovery. And we weren't directly involved with it, but Clive Cussler found a third U-boat. But then there were British U-boats that we located and smaller submarines that were unrelated to German technology. But yeah, every submarine is not a U-boat. A U-boat is a German submarine, correct?
Yeah. So what do you remember most about working with a legend like Clive Cussler?
You have to imagine where I'd come from, commercial diver with a great career and a really interesting life. And now, my passion of shipwrecks had become my new career. And to get to hook up with Clive Cussler and work with him, it was just such an amazing adventure and tremendous education too. It was a phenomenal time in my career and my life.
And I mean, you got to do this all with your son, which is even makes it more special.
Yeah, it's true. You know, like Curtis, I met you through your mom and dad. And And family is important. And, you know, I wouldn't have met you if it weren't for your mom, right? Your mom, your mom saw that I was this guy with a big problem on his hand, being sued by the treasure hunters from California. She didn't know me. She came out of nowhere to try and help. And she created this petition that she circulated, and thousands of people, thanks to your mom, started wondering, who is this Canadian, you know, battling these treasure hunters from California? So family matters. And, you know, when I was first approached as the underwater guy for the Sea Hunters, they said, well, you're going to need a dive team. And I said, yeah, I do, but I want it to be a really small team. I only want one other person. And they said, why is that? And Curtis, you know, when you get too many divers on a dive boat, everything starts to slow down.
Yep.
So now I only wanted one person, and I knew the right person was my son. And when I suggested Warren, they said, well, what is he, 5 years old? Because, you know, I'm 40 at the time. I still look like a kid. They couldn't imagine I would have a son old enough to be a responsible diver and underwater cameraman. But even at that point, which was the year 2000, was already an accomplished commercial diver and working in the industry. And he had grown up on the Kento, our tugboat, and with me all the time in the commercial diving industry. So he was smart, handsome, big and strong, and most of all, he had a vested interest in taking care of me. Which was all
yeah.
Yeah.
I guess your wife would appreciate that as well.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you're adding to your son's career, and your mom matters, right? Like you're in this case, it's Warren's mom. Yeah, she wanted the best for both of us. So yeah, she was excited by the idea that we were together.
So,
but nervous. We did some really, really dangerous stuff. And especially my mom would watch the episodes and just be totally freaked out. Like, we dove inside a British submarine, and she saw me sneaking and crawling through the hatches and worming my way around inside the wreck. And it really, really upset her. But, and I honestly have to say, Mom, that happened a year ago. I'm here now. Everything's cool. I'm fine. And I can't help but think that Warren's mom had that same worry about her son, because we put ourselves in a lot of dangerous spots.
Yeah, my mom didn't like me diving back then either, because and her reasoning behind it was because I was too calm in the water.
Oh, okay. But that's a good thing. You know what? People who are full of energy sometimes get really calm when they go in the water, and that's a good thing. That's a good sign. You got to have a level of confidence and a sense of adventure. But when it's time to focus, you got to settle down and focus. And I was that strong kid with lots of energy, but I really could focus when I got in the water.
Yeah, I find the exact same thing, especially since I've started diving again 2 years ago. I really notice how much of a difference it's made with me.
Yeah.
I should have never given up diving in the first place, but it's been amazing getting back into it. I'm actually side mount diving this year. I started side mount. So I've been doing that quite a bit, which I hated at first, but I love now. That's all I've been diving all summer.
Well, you know, as part of my evolution of diving, and I started out in scuba, but of course have dove in just about anything that can take you underwater, including the old standard dress, brass helmets, canvas suit, big lead boots. And I'm not afraid of change. Lots of commercial divers hate change. So many old divers hated to leave their big lead boots and canvas suits. And I embrace change. And I remember just for fun, I used to just take a regulator in a tank and just push it around. And I'd go to 100 feet like that. I just didn't have a harness, didn't nothing. Just
no harness even.
No, just, you know, there it is in front of me. Just kind of hang on to it and swim around. And as little gear as possible. No BCD, nothing. Just a wetsuit.
So what is the... What do you consider the craziest dive that you have ever had to do, either commercial or shipwreck-wise, that you've been involved with?
Well, when you're a commercial diver, every day you're faced with things, some often, not every day, but really challenging situations. And I started commercial diving when there were no rules. If you could go underwater and get the work done, that's all your employer cared about. There was way less concern about safety or lawsuits, any of that. And so in commercial diving, we would routinely do things that were sketchy. I dove to 200 feet of depth in a flooded tunnel, a quarter of a mile from the surface once.
Wow.
It's one thing to go there if you have a team of support divers or whatever, just to go there and come back out. But in the commercial diving world, you're there to work. Nobody cares that you got there. Nobody cares what you're doing. They just want to know you got the job done. And, you know, that's all that matters is getting the job done. And that's where I came from. That was my background. If you go underwater, you're not just there to look around and make bubbles. You're there to get something done. So when it came time to doing the Sea Hunter, the job was to get the footage, no matter what. And sometimes it took us to water as deep as 330 feet on scuba.
On scuba, you did that.
Yeah. But we also did, very early on, a dive to 320 feet on the clay quad all alone, but it was in hard at that time. So I had communication and mixed gas, which was a huge miss. But all alone in the middle of the night because the weather sorted itself out, calmed down. Way I went, we had already made we already had grappled into the wreck. Went down, weren't even sure it would be the wreck we were looking for. Creeping along in the dark, along the deck, stuck my head inside the wheelhouse, shone my light around, and it just lit up because it was full of brass. The steering wheel, the compass, the repeater, was a warship. Everything was brass, and it just shone and glared back at us. That was, you know, that was early on in the television career, and that was a big, big deal. And again, 300 plus feet. Oddly, Warren and I always seem to be in deep water. I think probably one of the shallowest dives we did in the 100 episodes of television we've done is, you know, somewhere around 100 feet. Especially in the real exploration and discovery shows, we're often in 200 plus, and then at times 300 plus. So, but the deepest was the Flyer at 330.
Wow. And have you done any rebreather stuff at all?
Yeah, I was rebreather certified, and rebreathers are a wonderful thing. They can make diving and access in remote areas really simple because you don't need a lot of support equipment. You don't need to carry a compressor. You can carry everything you need in one unit and another, you know, big bag of support gases and whatever else you're going to need, and go away and stay in a remote location for a week and make multiple dives, and everything fits in, you know, suitcases. That's not true of surface support diving. So rebreathers were a great idea, but for us, not the best choice, because Warren and I were always tasked with a lot of things beyond staring at our computers and making sure that a rebreather was not going to kill us or poison us. And for that reason, they just couldn't work for us. And it was early days of rebreathers, they would often fail. And if you weren't really paying attention, they would kill you. So after talking to Warren, he said, you know what? I'm sure in the future, rebreathers are going to be right for even like us and what we do. But right now, they're not. So we put the rebreathers on the shelf and we didn't touch them again. We like good old mixed gas in scuba or surface applied mixed gas. And if you got those things, you're a whole lot safer. Or at least in those days. I'm not suggesting that rebreathers haven't caught up, and they are now much, much safer.
I'm actually going to get to try a rebreather in November for a podcast episode. So I'm very interested to try it. I don't think I'm going to go much past that because I'm not sure since we've caught up, you know, I'm blind in my left eye.
Right.
So, so that presents a few extra challenges on a dive when you're monitoring multiple computers, gauges, all kinds of stuff, and trying to enjoy your dive. So I'm not sure I want to add a rebreather full time into the mix.
Yeah. Well, I got a feeling you'll sort it out and decide what works for you. And I mean, any sort of thing is dangerous. And it's just what level of competency and danger are you prepared to deal with, right?
Yep. And as we age, we also mellow out our risk assessment.
Everybody ages differently, that's for sure. I turned 70 next week.
Wow, 70. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
And are you still diving a lot?
No, not a lot, but I still dive. And after a long, long, long career, because I started in 1977 professionally, I made my first dives in the late 60s. After all those years, I can only say I've ever really had in one or two small mishaps. But now, for whatever reason, I keep rupturing my eardrum with way more occurrence than when I was younger. I guess the skin, every tissue gets less flexible and in general gets thinner. Anyway, I've blown out my eardrum a few times in the last several years. And that, I have to go much more careful because of that.
Which is funny you mention that, because there have been several divers over the last year that I know that are older like us, like Dan Manzuk, Matt Manzuk. Everybody's having ear issues when they're getting older.
Yeah. Well, it's going to happen. The skin wrinkles and the skin changes. And that's got to be true of your eardrum too, right? I suspect, I don't know. I'm only figuring this out as I go along.
So do you still have your own dive boat, the Kento?
No, the Kento is no longer in my possession, but the great thing is it's still out there working. I was driving through Toronto a year ago and saw her, and I was delighted to see that she still looks great after all these years. And, you get close to humans, you get close to things like boats, and I was really close to that boat. So she's still out there. She was certainly all the boats I rebuilt and turned into dive boats. The Kento was the biggest at 65 feet, but it was the most work and the thing I was most proud of when it was launched. But that's a boat you'll remember. Curtis.
And you actually had a recompression chamber on it at the time.
It was a full-on commercial dive boat, and I had contract work with it here in Lake Erie on the gas wells, and it was it was more than just a pleasure craft, that's for sure. And I was really close to it.
Cool. So now that you're getting older, are you still doing many Trimix dives or anything like that when you do dive?
I would for sure. I've eased into it. No problem at all using tech gear and diving deeper air. I was on the Atlantic diving a year ago when I burst my eardrum again. And that was just down air. So, 150 to 160 feet on air still. If I do any more really, really deep dives, like to 300, I definitely want a helmet and mixed gas. And somebody like Warren on the radio, on the surface, and a stand diver ready to come and get my sorry old bones.
Well, if you happen to make a trip out to the Atlantic in the next while and you want an extra diver, let me know, because I would love to go. I want to go do that one for sure still.
It sounds like that dive somehow got postponed from the early 90s when you had that first chance.
It was just the one time that it happened to be that we were around the same time when you were going out, because I was living in Toronto and stuff, and I happened to be back for the weekend, and I was actually on my dad's boat going out with him, and we passed you on the Kento and ended up turning around and grabbing my gear.
Okay.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember it. So many dives so many years ago. You, to me, were still just a young diver, full of energy and enthusiasm. Knew your mom and dad really well. Knew them not just as friends, but people who went out of their way to try and help me. And I knew them as good sailors. They've been around. They've lived on boats. They know how to chart a course, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's the one thing. I never did any diving off of his boats, though. His boats were not dive friendly.
Well, the more diving you do, the less fussy you get. And because Warren and I went all over the planet, we would find boats of opportunity, and they weren't always dive friendly. Sometimes they didn't even have motors. You'd be in some third world country. I'm reminded of the Mekong River diving there. And there were homemade boats with engines with no reverse gear. Just put it in gear, start it up, and you're going. Very, very crude. It's amazing what ingenuity, the third world has. And despite everything we have, they make great strides forward with nothing.
I remember watching that episode actually on the Mekong. Did you guys ever end up finding anything on it?
We found things, but we didn't find what we were looking for, which generally Warren and I didn't strike out. We had a really high percentage of finding the thing it is that we were hunting for. It seems nowadays television is all about spinning the story, and you don't even have to find the thing that you're setting out to look for. Back in the day when we did the Sea Hunters especially, if you didn't come home with the thing you were looking for, it was like, you guys are losers. There's no story here. Well, there's still lots of story. Anyway, that's what set us apart. We said we were going to go out and find something, and 90% of the time we did, and we came back with the goods no matter what.
Okay, so then my next question is, with it being in a river, how is it so hard to find?
Have you ever thought of diving the Mekong River?
No. It looked pretty wild from the video I seen just of you doing it.
Yeah, you could only go to this particular area at the low flood season. The Mekong is tied to monsoon rains. In the dry season, it's a much different river than in monsoon season. So we were there at the driest time of the year, but it's a massive, massive river. So, and sadly, where the wreck had occurred is in the most treacherous part of the Mekong, made less treacherous at the dry season, but still wickedly dangerous, unbelievable fast current, absolutely zero visibility. Like the water is it's like the Missouri River. It's too thick to plow, or too thin to plow, and too thick to navigate. The water is really flowing mud. That's really more what it is. So lots of challenges. We did not find the wreck, but we were in there swinging. We tried everything in the Fletcher tool chest to try and pull it off, but no, we did not get down to the wreck.
Wow. So did you even, I know that it's fast current and stuff, but did you get a better idea of where the wreck actually sits, even though you didn't get the it?
Yeah, we had a real capable magnetometer operator with his equipment, and he identified a target for sure in the right location. And we just were not able to get down to it. So we don't know to this day what's down there, how much of it, you know, may in moments be not buried in the sand and then suddenly appear again. It's in a really, really bad, treacherous part of the Mekong River.
So have you, have you found any like major treasure when you've been, diving, like gold or anything big?
We had a very clear hands-off attitude when we were working for National Geographic Discovery. Our attitude, and especially Clive's attitude, and Hornan, myself's attitude, Jim Delgado's attitude, was leave everything in situ, don't move a thing. So if there were gold on wrecks, and I know some of the wrecks we found and some of the wrecks we explored, I do believe there was gold there, but we never went digging. We never removed material to look. We weren't about finding gold. We were about finding the historic gold, the story. Only on one occasion, two occasions, did we recover anything at all, but only with the blessing of the owner of the wreck or the nation who owned the wreck, and the blessing of the nation whose waters we were diving in. When we were in Haiti, we recovered items that identified the wreck as a Mary Celeste, a famous missing ship, international story. And when we dove on the Dresden in Chile on Robinson Crusoe Island, we found the ship's bell. And it was a real treasure for the German authorities, and it was a warship. So they were anxious to get that bell back. And with their blessing, we paved the way forward for the Chilean Navy, who was our partner, to recover the bell and deliver it back to Germany. And I'm told it is the centerpiece of a memorial in the city of Dresden, which, as you may know, was destroyed by Allied bombing in World War II.
Yeah.
And I'm told that it is a centerpiece of memorial to the loss of the city and its citizens during World War II.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for joining me today on the Deadfoot Diver. It's been awesome talking to you. Hopefully I can get you back again sometime, maybe in the future, and do another interview on some of your exploits.
Well, all the best, Curtis, and be sure and thank your parents, because they're the ones who started all of this.
Absolutely. Well, I'm hoping that maybe next summer I can get to do a dive on the Atlantic with you.
Okay. So. Well, no promises. Who knows where I'll be in a year. But I'm still playing hockey. That's a good sign. Still playing hockey.
You're still playing hockey. Now, actually, I do have one quick question to ask you, because I do a lot of fact-finding off of AI, obviously, in this day and age. So it says here, one of the things that came up, and AI comes up with some really hilarious stuff sometimes, is that you do marathon running. Have you done any marathon running?
That's not entirely true. I ran a half marathon.
Oh, okay.
I set out to run the whole marathon, but only completed the half, but did it really well, and it was absolutely not prepared for it. So that's a bit of a falsehood. Hopefully that's the least important thing that might be out there that's not true.
Well, it's at least it's a half falsehood in that case, since you did do a half marathon. So
yeah, but even though I was out to run the whole marathon, I was in a very high percentage of the people who were purposely running a half marathon. So I was pretty proud of it, actually.
Yeah, that's impressive. I mean, I can't run, period, now. But yeah. If I run, it's more like a pathetic. I end up tripping.
Yeah. Well, make the most of what you got, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyhow, thanks again, Mike. Great having you on the show today. And remember, guys, grab an adventure and live.